Let's clear out winter and clean up the lawn with Spring Black Friday savings at the Home Depot. Right now, get the Ryobi One Plus leaf blower for just $89 and make your lawn work easier with a powerful 90 miles an hour of clearing power. And with convenient online shopping, you can order on the app, pick up in store, and get outside sooner. Get your yard spring ready with the Ryobi One Plus leaf blower, now just $89 during Spring Black Friday at the Home Depot. How doers get more done.
The Kakadu plum is an Australian native superfood containing 100 times more vitamin C than oranges. So why have you never heard of it? PR. No one's drinking a Kakadu smoothie? I'm JB Smoove, and that was a full episode of my new podcast, Straightforward, inspired by guaranteed straightforward pricing from AT&T Fiber. Get what you want without the complicated. AT&T Fiber, live like a gigillionaire. Available wherever you get your podcast. Limited availability in select areas. Visit AT&T.com/hypergig for details.
You can work from the road while turning your vehicle into a powerful high-speed data Wi-Fi hotspot with AT&T in-car Wi-Fi. On a network that covers more roads than any other carrier. Connect up to 10 devices and stream conference calls. Finish up that presentation or answer last-minute emails. Go to att.com/in-car Wi-Fi to see if you're eligible for a free trial today. Based on independent third-party data, always pay careful attention to the road and don't drive distracted. Wi-Fi hotspot intended for passenger use only when vehicle is in operation. Compatible device and vehicle required.
What do the most successful growing businesses have in common? They're working together in Slack. Slack is where work happens, with all your people, data, and information in one AI-powered place. Grow your business in Slack. Visit slack.com to get started.
Welcome to Stuff to Blow Your Mind, a production of iHeartRadio.
Hey, welcome to Stuff to Blow Your Mind. My name is Robert Lamb.
And I'm Joe McCormick. And Rob, correct me if I'm wrong, but I think this is finally the year that you've gotten full-blown into Rocky Erickson. Is that right?
Yeah, I would guess so. Yeah, I listened to him a little in the past, and this year I got even more into him. Yeah.
Okay, so Rocky has long been one of my favorite rock and roll vampires. And one of the things I love about Rocky Erickson monster songs is how much they're about the weather. So you may remember the line from his great anthem, The Night of the Vampire. If it's raining and you're running, don't slip in mud, because if you do, you'll slip in blood. I mean, that's just logic.
Yeah.
And there's a really infectious glee to that kind of logic. But also I enjoy the weather represented in songs like The Wind and More, which I know compares sort of the voice of Lucifer to the storm winds that are battering through the house.
Yeah, absolutely. And if anyone out there is not sure who we're talking about, you should look up Rocky Erickson, who also, what was the other group?
13th
Floor Elevators.
Garage Psych Band from the late 60s, early 70s, based in, I think, Austin, definitely out of Texas. Mm-hmm. Fantastic psychedelic rock. But then Rocky Erickson had a long solo career after that of all different kinds of music. You know, so some of the stuff he released, he had a lot of troubles with mental health, and at some points he was in psychiatric institutions, but even in those periods would sort of make these little demos of songs recorded, it sounds like just on a tape recorder, that are very simple but strangely beautiful. And then at other times he would make full-blown monster rock and roll albums. There's one called Evil One that's just fantastic. That's got a kind of Creedence Clearwater Revival style rock production, but all the songs are about demons and ghosts and 50s Atomic Age monster movies.
Yeah, and it's pretty hard stuff too. Like it's got a hard rock vibe that I think might surprise some people. I think it was produced by somebody from Creedence, if memory serves.
Stu Cook, I think so.
Yeah, but harder than Creedence, in my opinion.
Well, all that is preamble to the fact that today we wanted to talk about the intersection of ghosts and weather.
Yeah, and I have to stress that we absolutely won't be able to cover everything here because there are just too many storm monsters and storm deities out there, storm-related ghosts and other creatures. But we're going to be covering various examples that seem related to some of the core ideas that we were kicking around for this episode. And really, the central idea has to do with a recent trip you went on.
Oh, yeah. So I was recently in coastal South Carolina. Rob, have you been to coastal South Carolina? I assume probably.
Oh, yeah. And of course, South Carolina plays with a lot of ghosts.
Tons of ghosts. Everywhere you go there, like you can find a little local visitor center that's got a local self-published ghost author who's collected all the lore, and they've got it in a book that the font of the book is usually Times New Roman. But it'll have lots of great, you know, local ghost stories in it. And so there's one that I was reading about from a particular place on the South Carolina coast, a little island called Pawleys Island. And so to explain this, I want to refer to an article that was published by Myrtle Beach Online. So it's a local news article from the Myrtle Beach area. That's also coastal South Carolina, by a writer named Tyler Fleming. The article says it was last updated in September 2019. I'm not sure if that's when it was originally published, but it's this local news article trying to track down the origins of a bit of ghost lore from this area of the South Carolina coastline. And specifically, this is the story of a being called the Gray Man. You know, I'd say it's used a lot, but I'm still a sucker for that formulation of a creature name, just the blank man, especially if whatever the word in the middle is a single syllable.
Yeah. Like the green man, the gray man.
The tall man, yeah.
Mm-hmm.
So according to the legend, this is a spirit that wanders around on the shore, on and around this small island called Pawleys Island, South Carolina, usually appearing just before the landfall of terrible storms as a translucent gray figure stalking the beaches and boardwalks in a long cloak. Sometimes he's literally described as dressed like a pirate. And one funny, I think, little justified accusation of his identity is that he is Blackbeard. He is, I don't know how you're supposed to say his last name, Edward Teach or Teach or Thatch, however it is.
Yeah, with the burning brands in his beard.
Yeah.
This gets into an interesting area that I like about ghosts of this nature, because and this is all thoroughly non-scientific, of course, but we have this idea that that something bad happens and the ghost is like a lingering after effect of that thing. And then certainly there's also this idea that a ghost, say Blackbeard's ghost, or just this mysterious gray man, would have potentially insider information about what's going to happen. Maybe, you know, they died at sea and therefore they know the sea a little better and they can warn us about things. But then there's also an idea of hauntings as being things that work in both directions in time, that they can be harbingers of terrible events. Perhaps they're even attached to events that have yet to come.
Well, yeah, and that is exactly the case with the Gray Man. So contrary to what you might assume about this spectral figure, you know, crunching along through the sand and in the storms and the wind, local legend usually describes the Gray Man as a benign or even a helpful spirit. And the purpose of his hauntings is to serve as a warning to people who live nearby that a coming storm is going to be especially destructive. So as a few examples of this this belief among locals, I was looking at a 2018 article in Southern Living by Megan Overdeep about this ghost legend. And it describes how there were locals in South Carolina who claimed sightings of the Gray Man just before Hurricane Hazel in 1954 and Hurricane Hugo in 1989. But as a more recent example, also this article embedded tweets, like people tweeting grainy photos of alleged Gray Man sightings ahead of Hurricane Florence in 2018. So, Rob, I've embedded one for you to look at here. Listeners, you can go look up this article in Southern Living if you want to find these tweets. But this one embeds a photo that is allegedly taken at a boardwalk that goes over the beach on Pawleys Island. And there is, I don't know, so it's a very grainy photograph. It's got a lot of what looks like digital artifacts and pixelation in it. And then there's this big sort of pale gray smudge in the middle of it that looks, oh yeah, maybe like it could be some kind of vertical object on the boardwalk. But some people apparently looked at that and said, hey, it's the Gray Man.
Well, I have to point out that the tweet that is shared in this article, the tweeter does have a blue check mark. So this is verified. this is verified. Proof of the afterlife confirmed.
Yeah, as usual, why do sightings of the paranormal so strongly favor low fidelity documentation? I think, I'm not positive, but this looks like it's from some kind of like stationary live camera that sort of documents, you know, foot traffic on the beach. I think that you can tune into and see what's going on there. I'm not positive that's what it is, but I know there is stuff like that around there. And so that's what it looks like to me, but it could be something else anyway. Yeah. It's very grainy. It's got all, you know, it's got the pixelated artifacts in it, and I just want some high definition Gray Man, but I can't get it.
Yeah. I mean, obviously, I think that gets down to the fact that, yeah, sightings occur when things are obscured and uncertain. They emerge out of uncertainty and depleted visual efficiency.
Yeah, that'll come back later with something I want to get into in a minute. So to quote from this article by Tyler Fleming here, quote, not only does he warn people, but he is also known to protect their property from a storm. A woman in 1954 claimed to see the Gray Man ahead of the infamous Hurricane Hazel hitting the area. She said not only was her house spared from the devastation, the beach towels she left on her balcony were still hanging up.
So the ghost is like, oh, madam, those beach towels are just too beautiful. I can't stand to see them swept into the storm. I'll protect your house.
But what about all the people who died? I mean, shouldn't the ghost have prioritized the people instead of the beach towels?
It's probably like, I've seen people, but these beach towels, my God, they're beautiful.
So this article in Myrtle Beach Online goes on to list some of the local speculation about the alleged origin of this ghost. It does not mention Blackbeard. That one might be a kind of spurious allegation. Well, I mean, I think all of these are probably just made up later legends, but trying to track down at least what are the earliest of the legends. So the source that the article cites on these is the Georgetown Museum. Georgetown is a city near Pawleys Island. And so they've got a museum that has some stuff about this local legend. And one story, this appears to be the dominant one, is about a man who perished in the South Carolina Lowcountry in 1822. And the tale goes that this young man had been traveling abroad for 2 years. And in September of 1822, he decided he wanted to come home so he could see his fiancée. Back in South Carolina, and they could set a date for their wedding. And he was apparently in such a hurry to get back and see her face again that he took a shortcut through the marsh, and he ended up stuck in quicksand, which spelled his doom. And then his fiance, she's grieving over the fact that, I don't know if she found out that he died or if he just never showed up, but she's grieving for some reason, and she goes out walking along the shore. And she's treading through the sand, and while strolling alone on the beach, she sees a dark silhouette. It's the figure of a man, and she realizes that it's the soul of her would-be husband who died in the marsh. And she's so troubled by this vision and others like it that she has later that her family decides to relocate inland. They move away from that house. And the very next day after they leave, a hurricane sweeps through, leaving a path of destruction that would have killed them had they not left. And it's apparently this legend that could give rise to this common belief that the ghost appears to people to warn them of storms. And as a quick side note, I wanted to mention that I love that the story involves quicksand, which, of course, is one of my favorite plot devices. But that does have an environmental reality to it. You might not want to call it quicksand, but the South Carolina Lowcountry, especially the marshes, it's sort of like the mouth of the what they usually call the creeks, you know, the little the tributaries of water that eventually drain out into the ocean. These areas will form this buildup of fine sediment that is known as pluff mud. And so I was reading at least one article from the, I think it was the Hilton Head area, that was all about the story of a lady who goes out walking in the marsh for some reason, and she ends up stuck in the Plough mud, and she's there until like into the evening, and they have to send rescuers in to dig her out, because you can very easily get stuck in this stuff. You can sink into it. It's there are a lot of myths about quicksand and things like it, that you would like sink down under your head and drown. That's usually not a very common thing to happen, if it happens at all. Really, I think the risk of quicksand and even Plough mud is just that you would get stuck in it and have trouble getting yourself out.
Yeah, I've certainly been in, I don't know if it constitutes Plough mud or if it's just, you know, very wet sand, but I've noticed some coastal situations where you have a real real boot sucker or sandal sucker of a situation, you know, where the sand is just the right consistency that if you step into it, you might be pulling a bare foot back out.
Yes, and it's wonderful that it creates this almost untouchable terrain, because there are a lot of areas around in the low country where you can if there'll be a nature preserve and you can take a board walk out over the marsh. And if you look down on it, you can see all kinds of life. You know, things are happening down in the Plough mud. There may be these big colonies of oysters, and you can see fiddler crabs popping up out of holes and running around, and all the birds hunting them. But yeah, it's the kind of place where you wouldn't really want to go down and venture yourself.
Mm-hmm.
At least not without some special equipment, maybe like weight displacement boots or something. Now, apparently there are some alternatives for the origin of the Gray Man legend. To quote again from the Myrtle Beach Online article, quote, other theories tell a different story. One still has a man returning from sea, but this time his fiancée decided to marry his best friend instead. He throws himself into the Waccamaw, this is the Waccamaw River, which is a nearby river, and then later his fiancée and friend do the same. Other stories say he was an unknown sailor who washed up on shore and died shortly after. Some believe he is the original owner of Pawley's Island, George Pawley, who lived there in the early 1700s.
Mother's Day is coming, and Mom doesn't want flowers. She wants a cocktail. Here's a hint. Get Mom Bartesian. It's the countertop cocktail maker that creates your choice of over 60 premium cocktails in less than 30 seconds, each at the touch of a button. Flowers die. Happy hour comes back every day. So get Mom the machine that makes amazing cocktails with real fruit juices and craft bitters. Best of all, get $50 off a Bartesian premium cocktail maker with the purchase of one pack of cocktail capsules. So, instead of getting Mom a reason to fill a flower vase with water, get Mom the easiest, fastest way to fill her glass with the floral notes of gin. The best cocktails are premium cocktails, and the best day to get it for Mom is Mother's Day, because you can get $50 off now for a limited time. Visit bartesian.com/mother to get the best premium cocktail maker for Mom at the best price for you. Bartesian, premium cocktails on demand.
Today I'm going to give you some straightforward advice on how to deal with naughty kids. How about instead of timeouts, time ins? Time for you to start paying some bills. I'm J.B. Smoove, and that was a full episode of my new podcast, Straightforward. Inspired by guaranteed straightforward pricing from AT&T Fiber. Get what you want without the complicated. AT&T Fiber, live like a gigillionaire. Available wherever you get your podcast. Limited availability in select areas. Visit AT&T.com/hypergig for details.
You can work from the road while turning your vehicle into a powerful high-speed data Wi-Fi hotspot with AT&T in-car Wi-Fi. On a network that covers more roads than any other carrier. Connect up to 10 devices and stream conference calls. Finish up that presentation or answer last-minute emails. Go to att.com/in-car Wi-Fi to see if you're eligible for a free trial today. Based on independent third-party data, always pay careful attention to the road and don't drive distracted. Wi-Fi hotspot intended for passenger use only when vehicle is in operation. Compatible device and vehicle required.
There's a lot of pros to drinking Health Aid kombucha. No cons that I can think of. Pro, amazing taste. Pro, pairs well with anything. Pro, probiotic. That's a literal pro. And it's deliciously refreshing. It's the perfect pairing to your meal or great on its own, whether you're having pink lady apple, berry lemonade, or one of the other great flavors. It's the perfect swap for soda or alcohol. Make it part of your daily routine. Look for the brown bottle with an anchor on it and try Health Aid kombucha today.
Now, of course, this would be far from the only legendary supernatural being associated with weather phenomena. You know, there are tons of ghosts and monsters and creatures and gods that may not serve exactly this purpose, saying like, hey, a storm's coming, but they're in one way or another associated specifically with storms or other transient weather phenomena. And so while poking around on the subject, I came across what I thought was an interesting and kind of funny article. So this was on a weather news article by Michael Kuhn on AccuWeather.com with the headline, quote, Ghost Hunter, colon, thunderstorms cause an increase in paranormal activity.
Well, I mean, certainly if you've watched enough horror films and ghost movies, you know that this is the case. You got to have a thunderstorm going in the background.
Right. I mean, it's a classic of horror fiction, right? So you could argue about the order of causality there. But yeah, you know, you got the classic, the Bulwer Lytton line, it was a dark and stormy night. And then the idea that it seems that stormy conditions have long inspired gothic modes of thought. I mean, you know, there's the classic story of how did Mary Wollstonecraft Shelley come up with the idea for Frankenstein? It was during that summer when she and Byron and the whole crew were sort of like stuck inside due to this dark and stormy summer. Sort of, it was the year without a summer, which in a weird twist of fate, I think was likely due to volcanic activity on the other side of the world. But that was the summer where she worked out the ideas for the story that would become Frankenstein, sort of a foundational text of modern horror. And so it's kind of hard for me to believe that the dark and stormy summer didn't, in a way, play a role in the formation of that story in her mind. But but anyway, so this article about the paranormal activity in the thunderstorm. So the article consults a paranormal enthusiast named Mark Keyes, who at the time of this article, at least, was director of the Pennsylvania Paranormal Association. I looked him up, and it seems like he's featured on some ghost hunter type TV shows. And one that was, I forget the name, it was called like Paranormal 911 or something.
Mm-hmm.
And based on his quotes, I think this guy seems to take a sort of ghost realist position, at least. Like he cites, for example, the advice of a spirit medium as if he believes this is likely to contain information. And so,
do you think there are skeptical ghost hunters who you call them, they show up at their door and you're like, hey, I think I've got a haunting. And their first thing is, well, look, first of all, ghosts aren't real.
Well, there could be open-minded, but skeptical ghost hunters. I mean, I don't know. Yeah, like I feel like that's the attitude I would try to take. I would say, you know, I think most ghost sightings, or probably all of them, are not really spectral beings from another plane. They're probably something about the perception of the person experiencing it, but you don't know for sure. I mean, you at least look and see. Yeah. You try to find something out.
I mean, it would be beneficial to have more people in that mode. Yeah. Where like they're an expert, you consult, and they're like, okay, there are no ghosts, but here are a list of things that could contribute to this very real and potentially frightening experience that you have.
I'm sure there are some people like that, but I guess I would assume, this may not be fair, I don't know, but I would assume if you got like TV shows, you're probably at least for the cameras leaning into embracing the sort of ghost realist position.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, nobody's watched. I guess you could watch it. I guess I could imagine a ghost hunter show with this kind of a theme. Like, we're here to bust the ghosts, but not only the ghosts themselves, but the idea of ghosts. That could be fun. Kind of a Penn and Teller, kind of approach to it.
Yeah, sure. I don't know. It could be done well. Like, I feel like most things, you know, it could be done well if it was done well. But coming back to this article, the thing that really got a hook in my brain about it and that I thought was really interesting was that the article made an attempt to posit a physical mechanism by which thunderstorms allow ghosts to appear. And I think basically the implication is that ghosts need to get charged up by lightning.
Hmm.
It's not said explicitly, but this does appear to be the implication given by the guy cited in this article. So to quote from the article, some believe that apparitions or spirits need some source of energy to manifest their presence into the physical plane in order to communicate with the living. This could include drawing energy from electrical circuits and even batteries. And then this is quoting from Keyes. If a spirit is trying to manifest, that is, become physically visible, it will pull energy out of the environment to do that. This could include heat, as cold spots are commonly reported, as well as in areas where a haunting has been reported. It seems to be shortly after a lightning storm that they do notice an increase, he said. And then this is the part where Keyes claims that his psychic medium will back up the fact that after a thunderstorm, there is, quote, a lot more activity. Now, you know, as I think will be clear if you've listened to us for a while or even from our earlier discussion, I would say we generally take a, you know, broadly open-minded but specifically skeptical position on the physical reality of paranormal reports like this. So while we're not going to embrace the ghost realist position, I would be potentially open to the claim from the experience of a paranormal investigator who says that thunderstorms are correlated with increased reports of ghost sightings, poltergeist, hauntings, and so forth. So I think that could well be true, and that could well be informed by experience, because there would be nothing supernatural in that. You just have to say, well, yeah, people do say they get haunted more often after there's been a storm or around the time of a storm. But I would tend to think that if this is true, the mechanism would more likely be that the thunderstorm somehow causes the perception of ghosts and wandering spirits rather than literally conjuring them.
Yeah, I mean, we have to remember that what does lightning do but very briefly illuminates the darkened world. And just a flash, and gives us a chance to sort of fill in the gaps there with whatever you might, you know, expect to be there in the storm.
That's a really good point. And it's further informed by some of the stuff that's quoted in this article as like, what are the most common things people report as evidence of hauntings in their homes? According to this paranormal investigator, he says that, okay, so first of all, you've got visual evidence such as people witnessing shadows and spectral human forms, which, I mean, seems like a darkened sky and then like briefly illuminated flashes of lightning. That seems like, okay, that's sort of perfect conditions to create illusory perceptions of strangely shaped shadows and things like that.
Mm-hmm.
But then another thing that it identifies, and this is something that I think from my reading is a very common source of paranormal reports, what I would call appliance phenomena. So the article says, quote, reports of lights flickering and electronic equipment turning on and off on its own, even when unplugged, is common. Other people report more physical activity such as doors opening or closing, lights or TVs turning off by themselves. Believe it or not, we've had a lot of reports of stereos, radios turning themselves on when they're not even plugged in.
Mm.
And so, you know, it's hard to judge just from generalizations like this, but it's funny to me how much like everything that was just listed, except for the unplugged part, is stuff that would be pretty much perfectly explained by the physical effects of a storm. So like doors opening and closing by themselves. Of course, during a storm, you have wind and pressure differentials that can blow a door one way or the other. And then the appliance phenomena, that's the anomalous activation or deactivation of electrical appliances, which I know from personal experience, and probably most of you do as well, that this can happen due to storms affecting the power grid and the power lines leading to your house. And Rob, I don't know if you've ever had this happen in your house, but sometimes like power supply issues during a storm don't affect the entire house at once, you know? So like you can have, you can have like a power outage where just everything goes out. We usually recognize what that is, but we occasionally have stuff happen where, you know, like some parts of the house will kind of flash on and off and other things won't.
Yeah, absolutely.
Now, I think that would not explain issues where people are claiming that appliances that are not plugged in start turning on and stuff. Like a lot of the reports emphasize these extra levels of implausibility. You know, the stereo wasn't even plugged in and it started playing Waylon. And I have no way of knowing this, but part of me just kind of suspects that the appliance was unplugged claim in particular. It seems like a very likely exaggeration place to go. Like maybe you witness some apparently anomalous activation or deactivation of an appliance, an electrical appliance, and it feels really notable when you first notice it, but then thinking back on it, sometimes things do just turn on and off. This kind of needs some extra beef, and it's like, well, were we even sure it was plugged in? It might not have even been plugged in.
Yeah, I mean, we have so many things plugged in these days that sometimes it's hard to keep count of what's plugged in, what's unplugged, and you go to unplug one thing and you actually unplug the other. So plenty of room for misunderstanding and altered memory there.
Yeah, but so the other main fork of the storm causation here on the hauntings, I would think, would tend to be the effects of storms on human psychology, storms or even atmospheric conditions before or after storms.
Yeah, I mean, this makes perfect sense. You know, ghosts are often associated with darkness. Lightning, again, momentarily illuminates the dark. And even if it's not nighttime, you know, you have a storm roll in. What does it do? It brings a certain level of darkness and shadow with it. Throw in the rain, some booming thunder, and you have just a creepy environment.
Not just creepy, but I'm thinking about the informational and sensory effects of storms. Coming back to that grainy photo we were talking about earlier, I would argue mm-hmm. that stormy weather reduces the sensory resolution of your environment. So there's yeah. darkening due to cloud cover. Less light means less visual information, or certainly less certainty in your visual information. And then once you get mist and rain, visibility is further reduced. And wind and thunder and rain also reduce the auditory clarity of your environment. So imagine, you know, turning up the volume on a staticky radio channel. It's harder to discern the true signals, sound signals around you, and it's easier to mistakenly perceive a signal within the noise. And I think this would fit with what I said earlier about ghosts so often appearing these days on low-resolution film, video, and audio recordings.
Yeah, if I'm not sure what I see, if I'm not sure what is recorded in you know, one form or another, then that creates an opportunity to lean into some sort of supernatural understanding of what it might be.
Now, I was trying to think about other things here where could there be other sensations people get maybe when a storm is approaching that puts them in an alternative state of mind or has some detectable effect on humans that could lead to paranormal experiences. I'm not convinced on this one, but there are at least some questions I would like to pose. And so, for example, one of the things I was thinking about was barometric pressure. Mm-hmm. So we all live under atmospheric pressure. At sea level, under normal conditions, you walk around with about 14.7 pounds per square inch of atmosphere pressing down on and around you. But we don't normally perceive the weight of the atmosphere because we're equalized to it. And in fact, if a significant amount of that weight were to be removed, we could probably notice it. Like if you go high up enough, if you go to a high altitude, you can feel a difference in the reduced air pressure. Obviously, because, you know, the higher up you go, the less atmosphere there is is above you to press down. But air pressure at any surface altitude is variable. So at sea level, changes in the weather, changes of the heating of the Earth's surface can cause imbalances in barometric pressure. So as you have a region of the Earth's surface that gets hot, that hot air rises. You can almost imagine it being sucked up into the upper atmosphere by a giant vacuum. This forms a vacuum below it. It forms a low pressure system. And when you have a low pressure region, pressure is falling. That means air from the surrounding regions of the Earth's surface will flow into that area of falling pressure to compensate. And we perceive this flow of air as wind. This is what wind is. And then the rising warm air in a low pressure system also carries with it water vapor content, which condenses into clouds and eventually has to fall back down as rain. So falling barometric pressure is generally taken as a sign that storms are coming. If your barometric pressure is going down and your wind speed is increasing, you can be pretty sure there is a storm headed your way. So that's generally factual, but I guess what I was wondering about was, well, okay, so do signs like that, does low or falling barometric pressure have any effect on humans that could lead to sort of different states of mind or behavior? This one seems uncertain to me. I'm not sure. Psychological studies have tracked all kinds of effects of weather on mood, cognition, and behavior. And it seems to me that while there have been a few studies finding some effects of barometric pressure, if those effects are sound, they appear to be a lot more subtle than the stronger effects of factors like temperature. Mm. But to cite just a couple, at least, of the reported effects, for one example, I was looking at a study called A Warm Heart and a Clear Head, the Contingent Effects of Weather on Mood and Cognition. This was published in Psychological Science in 2005. This was a study of weather as a function generally of seasonal changes and looking somewhat into questions about seasonal affective disorder. But the authors here write in their abstract, quote, in two correlational studies and an experiment manipulating participants' time outdoors, pleasant weather, this would mean higher temperature or higher barometric pressure, was related to higher mood, better memory, and broadened cognitive style during the spring as time spent outside increased. The same relationships between mood and weather were not observed during other times of year, though, and indeed hotter weather was associated with lower mood in the summer. Though, of course, obviously, you know, you can have hot weather in the summer that is associated with low pressure regions that lead up to a storm. And to further elucidate their findings, they write in their results section that, quote, as in some of the previous research, and they cite Clark and Watson in 1988 and Watson in 2000, neither temperature nor barometric pressure was directly related to mood valence. However, the interactions of time spent outside with temperature and with barometric pressure were both significantly related to mood valence in the expected direction. As time spent outside increased, the temperature, mood, and pressure mood relationships became more positive. So basically, if you have participants, if you tell them they need to spend more than 30 minutes outside, higher temperatures and higher pressure are associated with better moods and outcomes. But if you have people spend less than 30 minutes outside, then the relationship is actually reversed. So like good weather outside and having to stay indoors apparently has a negative effect on mood and cognition in this finding.
All right. Yeah, I think most of us can relate to that. You know, if it's a nice day outside, but it's a day where you only get to experience that whilst moving from one indoor environment to another, yeah, that's kind of a bummer. But if you get to be outside the whole day or a large portion of the day, then that's great.
But unfortunately, so while this did look at barometric pressure as one of the things informing the weather states it was looking at, this combination of temperature and barometric pressure, what they were really looking at was like, what are the effects of good, you know, so like high pressure, high temperature. Mm-hmm. Is there anything that directly tests for? No. What is it about low pressure specifically? You know, that state when you would expect a storm to be heading your way. There are some other findings that seem potentially more directly informative on this question, but I also feel somewhat cautious about them. They don't feel super conclusive. So, for example, one study I came across was published in the Canadian Journal of Psychiatry in 2003 by Thomas Shorey et al., and it looked at documented emergency psychiatric visits to a city's psychiatric emergency room in the year 1999 in a mid-sized city. And they also looked at city police department data and suicide data. And what they found was, quote, the data suggests that total numbers of acts of violence and emergency psychiatry visits are significantly associated with low barometric pressure. But then they found that psychiatric inpatient admissions and suicides were not associated with any of the weather variables they investigated. So that's one of those things that's, okay, that's a bird's eye level observation of something that happened in one city that might merit further investigation, but I don't think we could say anything conclusive just based on that. So I would be skeptical about drawing too many conclusions from ideas about the relationship between barometric pressure specifically and psychology. But the conditions that precede a storm, both the obvious and cognitively recognized conditions like clouds, darkening skies, and thunder, and then perhaps some subconsciously perceived conditions like dropping barometric pressure or increasing winds, I think it could possibly give rise to a different state of mind when a storm is approaching, certainly the cognitively recognized ones.
Mom met a lot of your demands over the years. This Mother's Day, get her the Bartesian cocktail maker that makes premium cocktails on demand. In just 30 seconds, have your choice of over 60 premium or seasonal cocktails, all at the touch of a button. Get $50 off on the Bartesian cocktail maker now when you buy one pack of cocktail capsules. So, for all the times you made a mess, get Mom the countertop cocktail system that makes premium cocktails without making any mess at all. For all the times you begged for soda, get her premium cocktail capsules made with real fruit juice and craft bitters. For all the times you demanded tacos for dinner, get her the Bartesian that mixes margaritas in just 30 seconds. Make mom's Mother's Day and all the 364 days that aren't Mother's Day with a Bartesian cocktail maker at $50 off. Visit bartesian.com/mother now to get $50 off the Bartesian Premium Cocktail Maker. Bartesian, premium cocktails on demand.
Today I'm going to give you some straightforward advice on how to deal with naughty kids. How about instead of timeouts, time ins? Time for you to start paying some bills. I'm J.B. Smoove, and that was a full episode of my new podcast, Straightforward. Inspired by guaranteed straightforward pricing from AT&T Fiber. Get what you want without the complicated. AT&T Fiber, live like a gigillionaire. Available wherever you get your podcast. Limited availability in select areas. Visit AT&T.com/hypergig for details.
You can work from the road while turning your vehicle into a powerful high-speed data Wi-Fi hotspot with AT&T in-car Wi-Fi on a network that covers more roads than any other carrier. Connect up to 10 devices and stream conference calls. Finish up that presentation or answer last-minute emails. Go to att.com/in-car Wi-Fi to see if you're eligible for a free trial today. Based on independent third-party data, always pay careful attention to the road and don't drive distracted. Wi-Fi hotspot intended for passenger use only when vehicle is in operation. Compatible device and vehicle required.
There's two kinds of people in the world, people who love Health Aid kombucha and people who have never tried it. The bubbly mix of probiotic tea and refreshing juice is delicious and good for your gut health with great flavors to choose from that you can't help but love. If you've never tried it before, maybe try a bottle or can of passion fruit tangerine or ginger lemon. Your taste buds and your gut will thank you. Look for the brown bottle with an anchor on it and try Health Aid kombucha today.
So I think these are all excellent ideas to keep in mind as we proceed through the rest of the episode, where I thought we might just look at some various ghosts and monsters and sometimes divine or partially divine figures from around the world that have something to do with weather, or at least in one case has nothing to do with weather, but gets into the idea of a ghost harbinger.
Okay.
So, first of all, we'll go ahead and get the one out of the way that doesn't really seem to have anything to do with weather. Well, actually, I guess I have a couple of them here. And the first one here is Herne the Hunter. Have you heard of this particular ghost?
Not until you introduced him to me.
So this is apparently a ghostly, phosphorescent, mounted hunter said to ride through the woods surrounding Windsor Castle in the UK. He's covered in furs, and his head is obscured by the skull and antlers of a great stag.
Mm.
Now, when I heard about this, I had to, of course, look it up in Carol Rose's encyclopedic volumes on monsters and fairies and whatnot. And she makes a possible connection here between this legend and older Celtic beliefs in a particular horned fertility god whose name was Cernunnos. That's C-E-R-N-U-N-N-O-S. That's at least one modern spelling of it.
Mm.
But this particular apparition was referenced by Shakespeare, and in the 20th century, at least, has come to be seen as a harbinger of disaster, not of storms, but of economic and political disaster, which I found interesting.
Mm.
So sightings of the hunter here have been attributed to the 1931 economic depression, the 1936 abdication crisis, the 1939 declaration of war, and the 1952 death of George VI. Another version I've read is that Herne the Hunter always appears when a monarch is close to death.
Well, this raises a question for me about a distinction we could make about harbinger deities,
mm-hmm.
or maybe not deities. I don't know if Herne here is a god or just a creature or being of some kind, whatever you would call it. These harbinger beings, you could say that, okay, if they appear right before a disaster of some kind, whether that's a hurricane or an economic depression or the death of a monarch, are they appearing in a benign spirit saying like, hey, I have divine foreknowledge because I'm of the other plane. I'm not of this world, so I'm not bound by time. And I'm just giving you a warning. Like, I'm here to let you know so you can prepare. Or are they on the sort of disastrous causation side? Is like, are they an ill omen? Is seeing them in some way part of the causative structure of the disaster that comes, or do they even directly bring it about by appearing?
Yeah, yeah. You could see various interpretations, I guess, of what exactly is going on. And we'll keep discussing this, but another little tale that I read, this was in Rose's book, referring to work by folklorist Ruth Tung. It's a story. Tung writes of this tale that was circulating about three British youths who were decked out in the Teddy Boy style of the 1960s. Look that up if you need a visual of what that would look like. They were hanging out in the woods, and what do they find? A horn. And I believe the story goes that they were thinking, oh, well, there must have been some sort of a film shoot going on here, and they left a prop. We've got this horn. Let's go ahead and blow it. So they blow the horn, and then, sure enough, the unseen spirit begins to pursue them through the woods and, getting closer and closer. And finally, an arrow seems to fly and slays one of them dead, but there's not a single physical wound. It seemed to have been some sort of a ghost arrow. Mm. So that's a fun little tale as well. And of course, this all relates back to other traditions of the wild hunt myth, of some sort of a ghostly being or beings, sometimes in the company of hellhounds that goes out on strange hunts in the night, and you don't want to run afoul of them.
Something is incongruous between that and the Teddy Boy thing. I'm hung up on the Teddy Boy detail. Is this a commentary on the Teddy Boy fashion trend, or?
I think it's just, on the youth of the day. Okay. So it's like whatever the youth, you can imagine various youth fashion trends in Britain and then being reflected in versions of this story. It makes it seem very cinematic. I can imagine the cinematic version of this.
So if Herne has a stag skull on top of his head and you look up Teddy Boy hairstyles, I mean, you could see some certain basic shape and contour similarities where their pompadours look kind of like stag skulls.
Yeah, yeah.
I guess without horns, but
now as far as ghostly harbingers go, I know some of you are probably thinking of this. This is more in the realm of cryptids and UFOlogy, but there's the alleged supernatural harbinger of the Silver Bridge collapse of 1967. This is a bridge that spanned the Ohio River. The Mothman. There have been books and movies about this, but the connection, the original connection between the collapse and sightings of the Mothman, I'm to understand, are largely due to the writings of UFOologist John Keel. Mm.
I think this story is the inspiration behind the plot of that Richard Gere movie, The Mothman Prophecies, isn't it?
It is, yeah.
Yeah.
Wait. I've never seen it, but I'm familiar with
it. Oh, you know what? So we watched it a few years back. We like to revisit not just classic horror films, but, Rachel and I sometimes watch Fallen by the Wayside horror films that nobody really talks about anymore. And so this one was, what did this come out, in the early 2000s or something?
I think so.
Yeah, sometime around then. It has Richard Gere, and it's about this whole situation. And you know what? I got to say, it's not perfect, but it's got some good ghostly atmosphere in it. It was actually pretty spooky. Pretty solid thumbs up.
Now, there are some other harbinger spirits of note. There's the Caerath, which is a harbinger spirit in the folklore of Wales. It's a banshee-like being that wails and groans as she passes through the city streets at night, warning of impending disaster, including epidemics, which, of course, is interesting. And then, of course, speaking of, there's the banshee of Irish legend that wails under the window of a family member to portend that family member's death.
I guess this comes back to the question I brought up a minute ago, because I think I've read about this in the context of the banshee before, where it's not really clear to me whether the belief is that the banshee knows the death is going to happen and is sort of informing the family of such by their behavior, or whether or not it's intentional on the banshee's part. The banshee is letting them know, or the banshee's presence is somehow causing the death.
Yeah, yeah. So unanswerable questions about the strange doings of weird creatures. And I guess that's one of the reasons that makes them weird and otherworldly, is you don't know what their role in the whole scenario is. Mm-hmm. What are you doing here? Are you feeding off of the misery of and the bereavement? Or are you here as an agent of death? What exactly is going on? Are you trying to warn us? Or is it something to beyond any of these interpretations?
Mm.
They're here on ghost business. That's all you know.
Right.
Now, let's get back into just ideas of storms and rain and water and cataclysmic weather. So plenty of cultures have major flood, storm, and cataclysm myths, and China is no exception. There's, of course, the story of Yu the Great, who overcomes the deluge with drainage channels and earthwork. There's also the Chinese flood myth concerning the water god Gonggong, sometimes relegated as one of the four perils. So this is a vast serpent with a human head, red hair, and Gonggong is said to have caused a great flood by bumping into Mount Buzio, which caused the sky pillar to collapse, resulting in just cosmic disorder. You end up having to have the goddess Nuwa step in, repair the sky pillar in order to bring order back out of chaos. And sometimes this myth and the myth of Yu the Great are linked together. Mm-hmm. And then there's the myth of Hogi, the archer. You may remember him from his key role in the myth of the Surplus Suns, or his part in the lunar myth of Chang'e and the Potion of Immortality. But to refresh, during the time of the Ten Suns, Emperor Yao calls upon Yi to shoot the nine Surplus Suns out of the sky, and he does so, saving the earth from fiery desolation. But the time of the Ten Suns is also a period of great disruption, and many unnatural beings roam free to commit great offenses against the gods. And so Emperor Yao charges Yi with the destruction of these monsters as well. He has to hunt them down and slay them in order to protect the people.
So is this after the sun shoots down the nine Surplus Suns and then goes to have to, he has to clean up afterwards with the monsters?
Right. Yeah, yeah, because the cosmic disorder, it kind of is, you're left with the idea that it kind of unleashed these beings, or it created an atmosphere in which they could thrive, and now they need to be put back in check.
Rounding up the loose ponies.
Yeah. Now, according to the translators John Major et al. In 2010's The Huai Nanzi, A Guide to the Theory and Practice of Government in Early Han China, these monsters, these monsters that that Yi has to hunt down, they pop up in various warring states and Han works and seem to represent destructive forces of nature. One of these monsters you'll learn about next week on the Monster Fact, our Wednesday shorty episode. And that one, I think you can also make, there's also a strong evidence to support the idea that it represents some sort of natural disaster as well. Mm-hmm. But there's one in particular that's very connected to the idea of storms, and that is the wind bird Da Feng. So this literally means a strong wind. Sometimes I see it translated as typhoon. It's a giant, ferocious bird of prey that brings with it strong winds whipped up by its mighty wings. So everywhere it goes, it brings destructive winds with it. So, of course, Yi has to hunt it down. And he uses interestingly enough, he basically just uses the techniques that one would use in hunting birds, especially during this time period. He attaches a cord to his arrow and shoots the mighty bird out of the sky. He holds the cord firmly so that he can, you know, sort of keep track of it and kind of bring it down. And then he follows that cord to the site where he has grounded the mighty Da Feng, and then he cuts its head off with his sword.
Wow.
In other tales, Yi also exacts revenge on the damaging river god He Bo, who he blinded in one eye. And then he also hunts down or seeks a vengeance on the wind god Feng Bo, who he shot in the knee. So you might be a wind god on a chariot pulled by dragons, or a god who actually takes on the form of a dragon, but that doesn't mean Yi doesn't have a receipt for you if you caused a bunch of storm damage.
So this raises a thought for me. I'm thinking about what are the different influences that determine sort of what level the embodiment of the storms it represents within the pantheon, or maybe not even the pantheon, the sort of the supernatural theater of a mythological belief system. Because I'm thinking about these cases where you can have a specific monster or creature. In this case, it is a ferocious monster being that represents a kind of disorder. It is a pony that has gotten loose from a unharmonious phase of the universe, and it has to be slain and set right. So this is the embodiment of storms in this one type of mythology, but you have plenty of other mythologies where storms are not only part of the natural divine order, but they are particularly the power of the like most powerful god or the king of the gods. Think of, you know, the storm associations with Zeus or Jupiter, or the storm associations with the some of the chief gods of the ancient Near Eastern pantheons.
Yeah, it's interesting to think about this. Yeah, because you can, there's a huge difference between, you know, the storm that is caused by the high god or a particularly powerful deity, one that is worshipped, and a storm caused by various monsters that are rampaging. You know, things that represent cosmic disalignment. And yeah, you can have ramifications based on how you view that. But it's interesting, too, to think about, even in our modern times, what do we do with hurricanes and tropical storms? Mm. You know, we name them. And, of course, they're very good reasons to name a storm, to give it a human name. It helps in communicating things about that storm and tracking them, in making sure that people are prepared for this particular storm and not approaching it like, you know, the last storm. You know, each hurricane that makes landfall is coming in at different intensities, and it's going to affect a different area in a different way.
It does seem interesting that, I could be wrong about this, but my gut feeling is that people have an easier time knowing which hurricane you're talking about when they have names attached to them than they would if you were just referencing it by like a year or something, you know?
Yeah. Yeah. Like the storm of 97 or something. But if you give it a human name, yeah, you're anthropomorphizing it a little bit, just, you know, there's no way around it.
Yeah.
But people are going to remember it. People are going to know it's coming.
It seems to me that, like, when you say Andrew, that conjures up like specific imagery that you recall from being associated with that name, versus like if you were just to say the year number. I don't know. Maybe it would be different if we referred to it by years, but that's my feeling on it.
Mother's Day is coming, and Mom doesn't want flowers. She wants a cocktail. Here's a hint. Get Mom Bartesian. It's the countertop cocktail maker that creates your choice of over 60 premium cocktails in less than 30 seconds, each at the touch of a button. Flowers die. Happy hour comes back every day. So get Mom the machine that makes amazing cocktails with real fruit juices and craft bitters. Best of all, get $50 off a Bartesian premium cocktail maker with the purchase of one pack of cocktail capsules. So, instead of getting Mom a reason to fill a flower vase with water, get Mom the easiest, fastest way to fill her glass with the floral notes of gin. The best cocktails are premium cocktails, and the best day to get it for Mom is Mother's Day, because you can get $50 off now for a limited time. Visit bartesian.com/mother to get the best premium cocktail maker for Mom at the best price for you. Bartesian, premium cocktails on demand.
Today I'm going to give you some straightforward advice on how to deal with naughty kids. How about instead of timeouts, time ins? Time for you to start paying some bills. I'm J.B. Smoove, and that was a full episode of my new podcast, Straightforward. Inspired by guaranteed straightforward pricing from AT&T Fiber. Get what you want without the complicated. AT&T Fiber, live like a gigillionaire. Available wherever you get your podcast. Limited availability in select areas. Visit AT&T.com/hypergig for details.
You can work from the road while turning your vehicle into a powerful high-speed data Wi-Fi hotspot with AT&T in-car Wi-Fi. On a network that covers more roads than any other carrier. Connect up to 10 devices and stream conference calls. Finish up that presentation or answer last-minute emails. Go to att.com/in-car Wi-Fi to see if you're eligible for a free trial today. Based on independent third-party data, always pay careful attention to the road and don't drive distracted. Wi-Fi hotspot intended for passenger use only when vehicle is in operation. Compatible device and vehicle required.
There's two kinds of people in the world, people who love Health Aid kombucha and people who have never tried it. The bubbly mix of probiotic tea and refreshing juice is delicious and good for your gut health, with great flavors to choose from that you can't help but love. If you've never tried it before, maybe try a bottle or can of passion fruit tangerine or ginger lemon. Your taste buds and your gut will thank you. Look for the brown bottle with an anchor on it and try Health Aid kombucha today.
Health Aid kombucha.
Now to move elsewhere in the world, another one that I ran across is the Blue Men of Minsk. So there are a lot of merfolk myths and legends out there that involve the creatures having some degree of control over or knowledge of weather and storms, mm-hmm. and they're ultimately just too numerous to go through. There's a lot of similarities between them. But this one stood out to me. The mer people were said, this particular variety of mer people anyway, were said to haunt the Minch Passage of the Outer Hebrides off of Scotland. This body of water is known in Gaelic as Sruthnap Fir Gorma, the channel of the blue men. So this is also interesting because earlier we were talking about gray men, and here we are with blue men. Mm-hmm. So they were said to look like normal humans, except with entirely blue skin and gray beards. And it's a treacherous passage of water, apparently. And so the legend was that the blue men would rise up from their deep caves and they would summon fierce storms against trespassing human ships and wreck them. But wise captains knew that the blue men loved rhyming contests. So they could earn the ship's safety across the passage if they just had some great rhymes up their sleeves.
Hmm.
Now, Carol Rose, in her book, she shares that the myth is thought to be based on Moorish slaves marooned by Vikings in the area during the 9th century. And the idea here is that these individuals would have worn long blue robes and gray blue veils.
Huh.
And incidentally, the Tuareg people of Saharan Africa apparently do wear these fashions, like these are the traditional fashions of the Tuareg people.
Now, do you know if that's more of a kind of legendary explanation, or is that thought by any modern scholars to have any likely explanatory power in the origin of the myth?
Well, I was looking into it a bit, and apparently Scottish folklorist Donald A. McKenzie, who lived 1873 through 1936, was kind of the individual who really popularized this hypothesis. And today, I think there's some individuals who think that the true origin might just be accounts of the Tuareg people of Saharan Africa that traveled, some sort of communication of this idea. Maybe you have some sort of a merfolk tradition, and you combine that with some sort of knowledge of Tuareg people and what they wore, if not the Tuareg people, then perhaps predecessors to them that had similar fashions and similar dyes in use. Mm. But another suggested explanation is that this belief in the blue people, the blue men, that it refers in some fashion to tattooed Picts. Would have been people who were known for their tattoos, and the Latin origin of Picts is painted people.
I seem to recall this from the Roman period, at least some author talking about the idea that there would be people in, I don't know what they called it at the time. Was it Caledonia? The area that is now mm-hmm. Scotland, north of England. So you would have had Roman Britain, and then at a certain point that you have Hadrian's Wall, and then there are tribes that live north of that they regarded as very barbaric. And I think there's some reference there to these people being painted in blue, or their warriors being painted in blue.
Yeah. So ultimately, we don't know exactly what the blue men of Minch is referring to, or what influences or what combination of influences led to this tradition. But it was said they can control the weather. So it's certainly worth mentioning here. Now, another one, I have to get into the realm of yokai here for a bit. Mm-hmm. And I'm especially excited to talk about this because I recently picked up a fun little book to read with my son titled Yokai Attack, the Japanese Monster Survival Guide.
Ooh.
This is by Yoda and Alt and illustrated by Tatsuya Marino. And it's a fun little book with that has some wonderful illustrations, but also some great information in it. It's well cited and very informative and very fun for young readers. So I was looking through that and I was like, okay, I know there are some yokai that relate to the weather or to the water. So there's got to be something good in here.
Lay it on me.
Well, there's one by the name of Umibozu. They're known as the sea monks, a Japanese yokai said to resemble great black bulb-like beings with glowing eyes emerging from the water. And the black may or may not be fur if you could touch it, depending on the account. Mm-hmm. Also, depending on the account, they might be vengeful ghosts of the sea. And in this, they have much in common with some Chinese ghost traditions, the boat spirits or funayuri, which you'll find illustrations of as well. But anyway, the umibozu are said to rise from the surface of the ocean even during the day. Even if there's nothing going on, you know, with darkness and storm, but they bring with them atmospheric disturbances and storms. And of course, this means that ultimately what they're trying to do, of course, is they want to bring down vessels. They want to cause your ship to sink, drag it to the bottom of the ocean. And the smaller ones you might be able to drive away, but the larger ones are just too powerful.
Okay, so this would be more in line with the type of creature like the wind bird from Chinese legend that literally brings the storm and weather disturbances by its own, like it directly causes them.
Yeah, would seem to be the case. And these are fun ideas to get into as well, because first of all, the idea of any kind of enormous being, certainly, this black creature emerging from the water, it instantly makes us think of whales. And indeed, there may be some connection there between these legendary creatures and whale sightings. And also, there's the possibility that there's some sort of atmospheric ghost lighting involved as well, which is something worth remembering anytime you're dealing with ghosts of the ocean. But one of the interesting takes I was reading about the funayuri, the Chinese version of this, the boat spirits, is that they were sometimes attributed with ladling water into ships and causing them to sink, or just by their very presence causing compasses not to work. But they were also said to simply hold ships in place. Mm. And some have theorized that this might occur due to dead water. So this is a nautical phenomenon, which you see take at least a couple of different forms. For instance, you see it in far northern environments, you see this situation where slow-moving vessels can become stuck due to a thin layer of fresh water spreading over the sea from melting ice. But then also, you see the situation with internal waves due to shallow brackish water in the upper layer of the water column, making it where a ship will feel stuck in the water as if something is holding it there. So it's been hypothesized that this could be a possible, one of the possible reasons for this kind of myth. Like something is holding the ship in place. What is it? It must be some sort of ghostly presence.
Oh, yeah. I think this makes me recall. It might have been in our episodes about the sargassum seaweed that we discussed other supernatural ideas about the doldrums and ways that your ship can become stuck in water without a propelling wind.
Yeah, and of course that's interesting too, right? Because the idea of a terrible storm can be devastating to the ship at sea, but also a complete absence of weather can be equally disturbing.
Yeah.
Now, here's another creature that came up when I was looking around, and that's the Elbst, an interesting lake monster, this time from the folklore of Switzerland, centered on the lake Selzbergsee near Lucerne. Sightings are recorded from 1584 through 1926, kind of a bulky, multi-limbed dragon creature that may suddenly surface alongside boats and scare people, also may raid sheep herds at night and leave disturbingly mutilated bodies in its wake. But their appearance in the water was said to foretell a powerful storm. So I had to look this lake up. I wasn't familiar with it. It's also known as Seeley, and it covers 44 acres and reaches depths of 37 meters or 121 feet.
Mm.
Now, in Irish mythology, you also have the Fomorians. These were said to be the original occupants of Ireland who were defeated by the invading Firbolgs and then transformed into grotesque monsters or giants. And then, of course, the Tuatha De Danann come along and they invade and they defeat the Firbolgs. And so the Fomorians are sometimes attributed with power over weather, over storms, as well as given the power to blight crops.
Oh, yeah. We talked about Fomorians in the context of Cuchulainn or Cuchulainn.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Now, another interesting monster that is definitely tied to the wind, at least in its origins, are the harpies. And I think harpies are interesting because I think a lot of modern monster fans probably think of maybe two or three different things when you imagine the harpy. First of all, there are Ray Harryhausen's harpies from Jason and the Argonauts. Do you remember these?
Oh yeah, these terrible blue women with the large blue bat wings.
Yeah, they have bat like wings in Jason and the Argonauts, but they're pretty creepy, very gargoyle esque. Mm-hmm. Outside of this tradition, they're pretty weak enemies in Dungeons and Dragons. Not very impressive, but there are some cool illustrations of them. And then, of course, there's the harpy in the Last Unicorn, which is a terrifying and powerful creature that is pretty much the direct opposite of everything they are in Dungeons and Dragons. And so generally in our interpretation of the harpies, we think of grotesque hybrids of vultures and women, sometimes with other influences thrown in. I've seen accounts where they say that they have bear ears.
Bear ears?
Bear ears, like the ears of a bear.
I can't even picture bear ears. What do bear ears look like?
That's why I think we often just whittle it down to just old woman plus vulture. You know, because you throw in these other influences. Yeah, what does it even mean?
Okay, I just looked up bear ears.
Maybe Midmorin times.
Bear ears, they're little nubs. I mean, like, bear ears do not seem like especially notable kinds of animal ears.
Yeah, well, maybe it meant more during the time when this was attributed to these monsters.
That's such a funny choice. I love it.
Now, in Greek and Roman myth, the number of the harpies, it varies. There may be as few as one or as many as five. And in origin, they are linked to traditions of wind spirits. Mm. And we see that in the various names that have been attributed to them. So in Theogony, Hesiod writes, quote, "And Thaumas wedded Electra, the daughter of deep-flowing ocean, and she bare him swift Iris and the long-haired harpies, Aello, storm-swift, and Osepetes, swift flyer, who on their swift wings keep pace with the blasts of the winds and the birds, for quick as time they dart along."
Mm.
By the way, Dungeons and Dragons gives harpies a laughable 40-foot flying speed. Come on.
Oh,
that does not sound as fast as time.
What is so I don't know flying speeds usually. What is 40-foot? Oh, I think I've got a... I think my character, who's kind of a wimp, has a 30-foot walking speed. Is that right?
Yeah. Yeah, 30-foot walking is like a general humanoid walking speed. So the harpy can fly just a little further than a human being can walk.
Wow.
In Dungeons and Dragons, which is clearly, this is a creature that needs a reboot in the monster manual. Now, Homer also wrote of harpies, particularly the harpy Padarge, which means a swift foot. And this is said to be the mother of Balius and Xanthus, the steeds of Achilles. And in a more general sense, though, the harpy is a human-bird hybrid, of course, and we see a lot of these in global myth cycles. And it's often pointed out that this sort of particular hybrid between humans and creatures of the air, it often has some sort of connection between earth and sky, between the world of mortals and the abode of the gods. The harpy also specifically is often brought up as an example of the monstrous feminine in myth-making. So an imagined creature used to convey negative attitudes about females and female bodies.
Yeah, I think of it as a kind of standard genre of misogynist comment to compare a woman that you don't like to a harpy.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. But it seems that in their original form, in their origins, they were more like minor wind gods or wind demons, perhaps more in keeping with the Furies, who might descend on a mortal at the behest of a god. By the way, an interesting wrinkle in all of this that I think we've discussed before is that the sirens, who we often think of now, and this is represented in art, you think of mermaids or you think of, you know, beautiful veiled women emerging from the surf, but they were originally bird-female hybrids as well. And so ancient depictions of what we might think of as harpies in the modern sense might have been sirens, or in some cases just were something else, some other kind of bird-human hybrid. For instance, there's a tomb, the tomb of Xanthus, there's a carving from it, various carvings from it, I think, that you can find in the British Museum, and it's been referred to for a long time as the harpy tomb, and you see this winged female figure, though it's far from certain that these were sirens, but they were probably not harpies either. So I think it's still an open question exactly what this particular being is supposed to be.
You know, bringing this back to the special potency of weather mythology and weather monsters when it comes to sailing and ocean going, This reminds me of a few years ago, I had a conversation with the author Chet Van Duzer about his books about the history of depictions of monsters on maps.
Yeah.
And and one of the surprising things about that is, if you had to guess, okay, what are the most common types of sea monsters you would imagine depicted on a map? You would probably guess what? Some kind of like ocean dragon type thing, or maybe the Kraken, or like a snake-like sea monster. No, by far the most common type of monster, at least depicted throughout the Western history of maps, is the siren. If you're going to have one type of monster on there, it's going to be a siren.
And do you remember if it was the more merfolk style siren or the winged siren?
I'm cautious to answer that because I'm not positive, but I seem to recall representations both ways. Though I guess the winged version would probably be closer to this association with weather events.
Yeah, I would think so. Yeah, and certainly the curious nature of winds and winds at sea. And I guess that's where a lot of this comes back to. Like, how do we today, and how have people throughout history thought about weather patterns, particularly destructive weather that seem out of the normal, that are unique and dangerous? How do we think about those? Are those the work of strange creatures that we can't quite understand? Are they cosmic anomalies? Might there be some sort of magical being that would warn us if these are occurring? Is there some hero that could protect us from them, that could slay these monsters and return the world to some sort of normality? It's fascinating to think about.
I wonder about something else, coming back to gray man type sightings of, you know, the being that would warn you about a coming storm. I wonder to what extent legends like that could also sort of be going the other way in terms of our internal mental causation, meaning like how much of it is based in people have some kind of experience. You know, they see what they think is a spectral figure or a spirit or something, and they want it to mean something. They don't want it to just be, I saw something weird and there's no reason for it. So they try to connect it to something significant. It's trying to tell me X. This means Y. When we have unusual experiences, I think it's very natural for us to try to say, no, that was not just an unusual experience. It was an indication of something. It was somehow informative. It meant something. And it seems like possibly the single easiest place you could go to there is connecting it to external environmental events like the weather.
Yeah.
I mean, I think this is one reason there's so much weather lore where people can say, oh, you can tell a storm's coming when a cow sits down at night or something. Like, you know, there's a million sayings like that. And it's because weather is constantly changing. So there's just like constant opportunities for you to observe one thing and then something happens with the weather and you make a connection there.
Yeah. And our mind is constantly looking for those connections. We want to make those connections. And often with weather, the stakes are enormous, particularly when we're talking about highly destructive weather patterns. So, of course, we're looking for some sort of connection between the things we see in the world and what's going on in the weather. And that includes things we don't completely see, you know, or we miss-see or we misinterpret, or hallucinations and so forth.
And so, yeah, I think that one place I was going with that is that perhaps that selective sort of meaning seeking whenever you have a strange experience could lead to a form of selective reporting that informs. Mm-hmm. So, you know, somebody thinks they see something weird in a photo or thinks they see something weird on the beach and then nothing happens the next day. Well, maybe I don't know who they really tell about that. But if the next day the hurricane hits and you think you've discovered some kind of informative correlation there, you might be much more likely to tell everybody this story.
Yeah. If not the weather, then perhaps there's something else that occurs. Mm-hmm. You know, you see something strange, and then the next day a monarch dies, or a storm occurs, or a family member grows sick. Then you can make that connection. You'd be like, ah, this is what that was about. It didn't happen for no reason. It was a warning. It was a communication.
But yeah, it's funny because if you broaden it that much to just like basically any significant event, I mean, there's always something in the news. you know, it's like something happens every day.
Yeah, I mean, stuff happens. It seems to happen for no reason. And if that's the case, you know, you have nothing. But if you have ghosts, well, then you have everything, right?
Very nice. Very nice.
To bring it back to Rocky.
Well, you know, they say the moon to the left is a part of my thoughts, and a part of my thoughts is a part of me is me. So maybe before our fangs get too long, we should cut this episode off.
All right. But of course, we're going to be discussing lots of ghostly and monstrous things for the rest of this month, and probably a little bit beyond. We're well into the season now. So stay tuned. It should be fun. In the meantime, if you want to listen to other episodes of Stuff to Blow Your Mind, our core episodes are on Tuesday and Thursday. We have an artifact or a monster fact on Wednesday. Monday is Lister Mail. Friday is Weird House Cinema. That's our time to just unwind and discuss a weird film. And of course, we have some very spooky films to discuss this month as well. And then on the weekend, we do a vault episode, which is, of course, a rerun from the previous year.
I just want to give a teaser that this week's episode of Weird House Cinema, I think, is without a doubt going to be our longest, most epic episode of all time. And may remain that way because, yeah, I don't know if it can be outdone.
Oh, I wonder if it's longer than the movie itself. I think we've had that happen at least once. Okay.
Yeah.
All right. Well, tune in to find out what that is.
Huge thanks, as always, to our wonderful audio producer, Seth Nicholas Johnson. If you would like to get in touch with us with feedback on this episode or any other, to suggest a topic for the future, or just to say hello, you can email us at contact@stufftoblowyourmind.com.
Stuff to Blow Your Mind is a production of iHeartRadio. For more podcasts from iHeartRadio, visit the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you listen to your favorite shows.
Today's episode is brought to you by Visible. The future of wireless is here, and it's transparent. Switch to Visible, the wireless company that makes wireless visible. Get a one-line plan with unlimited 5G data powered by Verizon, just $25 a month, every month, taxes and fees included. No hidden fees, no surprises, no, really.
What are you waiting for? Get with the times and switch to Visible at Visible.com. Monthly rate on the Visible plan for data management practices and additional terms, visit Visible.com.
There's two kinds of people in the world, people who love Health Aid kombucha and people who have never tried it. The bubbly mix of probiotic tea and refreshing juice is delicious and good for your gut health, with great flavors to choose from that you can't help but love. If you've never tried it before, maybe try a bottle or can of passion fruit tangerine or ginger lemon. Your taste buds and your gut will thank you. Look for the brown bottle with an anchor on it and try Health Aid kombucha today.
Health Aid kombucha.
Open a limited-time 11-month certificate at Kemba Financial Credit Union. At 5.25% APY, it's more than triple the national average, plus it's a safe and secure way to grow your money. Visit your local branch or kemba.org/cd for details. Offer expires May 31st, 2024. APY equals annual percentage yield. Restrictions apply. $500 minimum and $250,000 maximum deposit. Advantage status required. Comparison based on bank rate average. Federally insured by NCUA.
You don't have to hop a plane to see the world. This month's Free This Week picks on Xfinity brings you around the globe. Experience life at a European resort in the hit comedic drama Seaside Hotel from Walter Presents. Watch romance blossom abroad in a Scottish love scheme from Hallmark Movies Channel. Celebrate Earth Month with planet-saving docuseries like EcoEye with Duncan Stewart on Magellan TV. And be transported to your happy place with iHeartRadio's Feeling Good playlist. Just say Free This Week into your Xfinity voice remote.